After 14 years of steadfast denials and accusations against his accusers, Pete Rose admitted what everyone knew.
You have always denied publicly that you bet on baseball. Did you bet on baseball?
Yes, I did, and that was my mistake, not coming clean a lot earlier.
That's an excerpt from an interview with Charles Gibson that first aired Monday morning on Good Morning America. The full interview runs tonight on ABC. There's also an autobiography out today called Pete Rose, My Prison Without Bars. Excerpts were featured in this week's issue of Sports Illustrated magazine. The story rates a prominent place on every sports page and on every sports talk show around the country. We'll speak with a reporter today who's covered this issue for years. We'll get a review of the book. And in a few minutes, Roger Kahn will join us. He co-wrote Pete Rose's first autobiography. And in a vintage week for admissions, we'll talk about the nature of apologies, why we make them, and why we accept or reject them. But we'll begin with Pete Rose's confession. What did he say? Is it the truth? Will Major League Baseball rescind his ban? Will he and should he be enshrined in baseball's Hall of Fame? If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us on the phone from Langhorne, Pennsylvania, is Jerry Krasnick, ESPN.com baseball insider. And on the phone from Los Angeles, we have Elise Minkoff. She's a Page 2 columnist for ESPN.com and a freelance writer. And it's good of you both to join us today.
Thanks for having me.
Nice to be here.
Elise, let's begin with you. You've actually read all 288 pages of this book, putting aside the sensational revelations about gambling. How's it read? What kind of a book is it?
Oh, it's brilliant. It really is. I started reading the book at about 4 o'clock on Monday afternoon and finished it about 4:30 Tuesday morning.
Wow.
It's an incredibly compelling story. The just sort of deliciously nefarious characters, the descent to hell and back and back and forth again. I've always wondered who those sleazy guys are that attach themselves to sports personalities. You see them everywhere, and Pete really makes you feel like you're standing there as he's handing over the money to make those bets.
In the presence of the leeches.
Indeed.
How did you get a copy of the book? That's in advance.
I call Jeremy Katz, the executive editor, and say, "Hey, Jeremy, we've been friends for a long time. Can you slip me a copy?" And he said, "Absolutely not. Strict embargo. Well, all you have to do is tell me that something's impossible, and I'll prove you wrong in about an hour and a half." Called a bunch of bookstores. They said, "We can't sell it to you." I found a bookstore that agreed that they would give me the copies of the book on Monday afternoon, but not charge my credit card until today. So technically what I have in my possession until this morning, at least, was a shoplifted copy, actually two copies of the book.
From an unnamed bookstore, because they weren't even supposed to open the cartons until today.
Indeed, indeed. And I was a very, very popular girl at just about every bar and restaurant in Los Angeles. No man ever talks to me in Los Angeles. I have my own breasts. But walking around with Pete Rose in my hand, I was very, very popular.
Jerry Krasnick, I understand that you asked for an advance copy as well.
Yeah, I had a slight problem. My copy was supposed to be delivered today in the initial FedEx run, and some temp service person at Rodale accidentally put in a copy of Chaka Khan's new autobiography. So that's what I have. Well, I'm not planning on writing anything for ESPN. I've been assured that I will be receiving my Pete Rose book by tomorrow morning.
Did she gamble on baseball?
Chaka Khan, no. I did read the discography. It looked interesting, but it wasn't really sort of in my realm as a baseball writer.
Well, Jerry, you covered the Reds for the Cincinnati Post back in the late 80s when this blew up into such a big story. After all these years, are you surprised it's still making headlines?
Yeah, to be honest with you, I think when 1989, when Pete was banned from baseball, I don't know that I would have envisioned that in 2004 we would still be talking about it. I think it's a reflection probably of Pete's hard-headedness, and Pete, probably self-delusional, thought that eventually, him being Pete Rose, this thing would blow over and he would be back in baseball. One of the things I think that certainly happened that didn't help his cause was Bart Giamatti, the commissioner at the time, died about a week after suspending Pete. And you know, that certainly cast a pall over things. And I think, you know, I don't know if Bud Selig and Faye Vincent and the other people blamed Pete for his death, but it's certainly a theory that people have run out.
Well, Elise, in your review of the book, you write about a story that's a lot bigger than a man who bet on baseball. You write about a man obsessed.
Completely obsessed. He is a tragic figure of his very old making. The love that he has for gambling is as palpable throughout the pages of the book, very, very early in, and it's as clear and passionate as his love for baseball. He is a completely self-destructive man, and it's fascinating to read. It's like watching a train wreck.
That aspect of feeling like he was bulletproof, he was the hit king, nothing could touch him.
Right, and that is, you know, what I find fascinating is saying I'm a gambling addict, but I occasionally like to go to the track. That's sort of, to me, like saying I'm a heroin addict and I only shoot up every other Thursday when, you know, when Marge is in town.
It's a little difficult to credit. Jerry Krasnick, the thing that he admits in the book, and I'm going by the excerpts in the Wire stories, and Elise, if I'm wrong, correct me, but he says that he admits to gambling back in 1987. He was still in uniform as the manager of the Reds. You go back to the Dowd report that was the put together by the lawyer hired by Bart Giamatti's successor, Bart Giamatti, rather, and that says he started betting in 1985 when he was player manager, still going after Ty Cobb's record.
Yeah, I mean, I think to me, as a Hall of Fame voter, that's a very major issue. You know, I've sort of incurred the wrath of some people by saying, look, I would... until it's proven to me or that Pete admits or whatever that he bet on baseball as a player, I'm not voting him into the Hall of Fame because of his managing skill. He wasn't even that great a manager.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I certainly draw a distinction between that. There are other people who say, well, he was a slime ball. He bet as a manager, so he fails the character test, and I won't vote him in as a player. So to me, that's a very major issue that I would like to see resolved at some point, but other than hearsay, I really don't know if it will be.
Elise Minkoff, in your review, there's an interesting phrase. The bottom is an interesting place to look up from, especially when you're Pete Rose. Do you think he has perspective on himself at this point?
Wow, what an interesting question. I think to the very limited bandwidth of emotions that Pete Rose has access to, yeah, I think... to go from the highest of the highs to spending 5 months in federal prison, one of the scenes that really struck out in my mind was when his wife was visiting him, and there was a Big Mac or some sort of hamburger in her pocket, and he wolfed it down because he hated the prison food.
Mm-hmm.
I was in that visiting room with them. So, you know, you go from, you know, home run king to, you know, wolfing down a bite of a Big Mac. And having Vitellus snuck in so you could dye your hair in prison.
And this was when he was did 5 months for income tax evasion, right?
Yeah. 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 What I think was really interesting, and he's very good at sort of shifting the blame to other people, the conversation that he had with Ubaroth, where Ubaroth sort of acknowledged that he had a problem, but that it wasn't really a problem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wasn't really dialed into professional baseball at that time, nor the political machinations behind it, but everybody knew this guy had a problem. Why, oh, why didn't, and it wasn't an intervention made?
Peter Ueberroth, of course, was baseball commissioner before Bart Giamatti. And I guess that's a question to you, Jerry Krasnick. There are rumors of investigations by Major League Baseball into betting allegations by Pete Rose going back into the 70s.
Well, yeah, I think, you know, it ultimately is up to Pete to admit that he has a problem, you know, and that's, if he had done this in 1989, you know, and said, look, I have a problem, I need help, somebody help me out of this, I made a mistake, America is very quick to forgive heroes and would have let him off the hook. I think the reason people feel so betrayed is because, you know, it was up to Pete to take that step, and I think everybody knew it was up to Pete to take that step, and Pete just... it's the same sort of stubbornness and bullheadedness that made him a great player is what has really contributed to his downfall as a person. is that he just wasn't willing to admit that he had this weakness, and he carried on this charade for so many years, and now that he's, you know, being contrite and trying to apologize, it's coming off as very hollow to most people.
But as Elise points out, baseball did its best to look the other way for a while, too.
I think that's probably to a point, you know, but like I said, short of him, he has suffered for this. You know, he hasn't been able to be employed. He's been a pariah. He's been out of the game. So you can say, you know, baseball, he did sort of get what he deserved, which is that he is not in baseball right now, and he's a national sort of disgrace and a tragic figure. So it's not as if there haven't been any repercussions.
I'm in no way apologizing for Pete Rose's behavior, and I did pose this question in my review. Would the story have ended any differently had Major League Baseball intervened at the first few whispers of his problem?
Let's get a listener involved, and Marty joins us now on the line from St. Augustine, Florida.
Thank you very much. I'm a retired policeman, and I'm looking at this as an integrity issue solely. A cop steals $1. He's a crook. Now, what Pete Rose did, we loved him as a player and personality and everything. And I also overlap Jim Thorpe somehow. I always remember back what happened with him. But that was splitting hairs or whatever. In this case, what he did, was it against the criminal law? Was it against the baseball law? If he did it with a violation of those two edicts or statutes or whatever, then we know what the answer should be as far as punishment. As far as contrition and feeling sorry, I said this as a cop for 20 years. It's not against the law to commit a crime. It's against the law once you got caught, and he got caught. So basically that's it. We have to decide for ourselves, but put the emotions aside. Make believe we're a jury now, and just look at the evidence in front of us.
Marty, what do you think?
What are you saying?
You think he should be made eligible again?
Again, I haven't really done the research, but I'm going to go by just the facts. Emotionally, he is a historical figure, and he should have a spot in Cooperstown, as far as my emotions tell me. But we would have to make a separate section for him, maybe a bad boy section.
He wouldn't be alone. Jim Thorpe, of course, who Marty referred to, the great American Indian athlete who earned a gold medal and then had to give it back in the Olympic Games and had it taken away because he played in a semi-professional baseball game before and thereby, according to the rules at the time, had violated his eligibility. Elise, before we let you go, you've read all of this book, all 288 pages. At the end of the day, what does Pete Rose say about himself?
I think he is brash, humiliated. I think he'd like to sort of stand back and look at it and make some apologies. Do I believe that he's contrite? Is it contrition of convenience? My big fear is that this publisher is going to be looking very, very quickly at feeling as badly as the last publisher did. I think a liar is a liar, and once a liar, always a liar. So, but here's an interesting: what if Cooperstown was to induct him? What if Felix said, "We'll induct you posthumously," so he doesn't get any of the glory of it when he's alive, with, you know, right under his picture, banned for life from baseball for gambling with the stats. You know, would people be happy with that?
Elise Minkoff, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Elise Minkoff, a Page 2 columnist for ESPN.com. Jerry Krasnick, we appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
Jerry Krasnick, baseball insider for ESPN.com. When we come back from a break, Roger Kahn, the author of Pete Rose's previous autobiography, will join us. This is NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing Pete Rose, also known as Charlie Hustle. This week, he finally admitted to what so many people were convinced of already, that he bet on baseball while he still worked in the game. The question now is, should he get into the Hall of Fame? What do you think? Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. Roger Kahn joins us now from his home in Stone Ridge, New York. He's been writing about baseball for the last 50 years, perhaps best known for The Boys of Summer. But he also collaborated with Pete Rose on his first autobiography called Pete Rose, My Story, published in 1989. In that book, Rose denied gambling on baseball, a denial he retracts in his new book, which we've been talking about, Pete Rose, My Prison Without Bars, which is released today. And Roger Kahn, thanks very much for being with us today.
Well, it's a pleasure. I remember vividly, maybe 20 or 30 times, saying to Rose, have you bet on baseball? Because he bet on other sports in my presence.
Hmm.
And he would look at me with a very earnest sort of little boy look. And Rose's diction is not very good. You know, you're not going to confuse Pete Rose with Laurence Olivier. And he would look at me and say, I didn't bet baseball. I got too much respect for the game.
Now, when you say he was making bets in your presence, was that at the ballpark?
Give me that again, Neil. When I was what?
When you say you watched him make bets, was that when you were at the ballpark?
Actually, in a clubhouse in Tampa, Florida, where the Reds were taking spring training, and he didn't bet on baseball. But I said to him that I was kind of glad it was March and that basketball was winding down and baseball was coming in. And Pete said, it was just the two of us. Pete said, March is great. The Final Four, you get to make some good bets. And he said, look who I like. And it was Duke or Wake Forest or Duke of North Carolina, one of the colleges in the Carolinas. And he was going to make a bet. He said, you want to bet with me? I got good information. And I said, no thanks. And he wrote down what he wanted, and a clubhouse boy went out and ran the bet from the Cincinnati Reds spring training clubhouse to a bookie somewhere in Tampa. And I said, should you be doing this? And Pete said, everybody does. Neil, I've been, you know, not counting Sandlot and stuff, but I've been in major league clubhouses since 1951. And, of course, there's a little bit of gambling on gin rummy or bridge or something like that or a lottery. I never saw before or since somebody place a bet with a bookie out of a major league clubhouse.
Now, when you co-wrote this book with Pete Rose back in 1989, that was the period at which John Dowd was assembling his report. You wrote in an op-ed piece in the Los Angeles Times this past week that, in a sense, you felt like you were making up the case for the defense.
That was the point. Well, first there was a first investigation of Pete Rose under Peter Uberoff, and that exonerated him of sports betting. And then there was a second investigation, and that was the one where Bart Giamatti and Faye Vincent hired John Dowd. My first thought when all of this began to break was, why hire Dowd? Dowd is a prosecuting attorney. He goes for a conviction. There was a Supreme Court Justice, Lewis Powell. He had a judicial temperament. So why not get Lewis Powell? Baseball has a lot of money to pay. You can get outstanding jurists. And Powell would bring to this a judicial temperament. Well, Dowd didn't, and Vincent didn't. So this whole investigation went on behind closed doors. Rose was denied the right to have an attorney present at these interrogations so that there was no cross-examination. All that we like in the American judicial system, free and open discourse, cross-examination before the public and indeed the media, that was denied to Rose. And I thought, why are they doing it in this McCarthyite way? And I had grave doubts about it. And when the Dowd report came out, baseball mounted a huge campaign, and most of the media people thought it was okay. Samuel Dash, a name you may remember, was the chief counsel for the Watergate investigation of Congress, which got Nixon out of the White House. Sam Dash said, he looked at the report, he said, if John Dowd gave me a report like that, I would have fired him. So it's a mistake to think that baseball's case against Rose was overwhelming. It was full of holes. The only case that was worse was Rose's defense.
And after this revelation this past week, you've written it, you were embarrassed.
well, that's what I am. Somebody said to me, a very good baseball writer said to me, do you feel betrayed? You know, if one of my children denounced me, my wife said I was a bum, I would feel betrayed. I don't know. We weren't that close. It was a business relationship. He lied to me for 4 years, and when he lied to me, he was also lying through me and through my reputation and through the many books I've done to the American people, to children. And that's terrible behavior, but personally betrayed, no. I just feel embarrassed. I think I'm a pretty good reporter, and I spent a lot of years trying to get this story right, and now all of a sudden he turns around and says, well, I lied. Let me in the Hall of Fame.
Let's get a listener on the line. This is Aaron, and he's with us from Salem, Indiana.
Hi, Neil.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I want to preface this by saying I am a professional baseball player, though never on Pete Rose's level. And I was just wondering if he can make it into the Hall of Fame without them lifting the lifetime ban.
Did you get that, Roger Kahn?
Yeah, I can tell you that there is something called the eligible list. The Hall of Fame is, that's a good question. The Hall of Fame is distinct from baseball. It's supported by a private foundation. Mm-hmm. But they work hand in hand. And the reality is, if you are not on the eligible list, if you are not eligible to play, manage, do all of the things that you do in professional baseball, you will not get in the Hall of Fame. And my feeling is that Pete reminds me of, say, a pilot who crash lands 8 times. You take away his license. Now, I don't think Pete is an evil person. I think he's a person with a lot of character deficiencies.
Yeah.
So here's what I would say. Pete, you've lost your license in baseball. You'll never play, you'll never manage, you'll never coach, you'll never go in the Hall of Fame. Well, what about the rest of my life? Pete, become a shepherd.
Aaron, what you say you weren't at Pete Rose's level. Very few players were.
But what's that?
I was talking to Aaron.
Yeah, they have independent leagues around the United States.
I know them well.
Yes, and I've played in 3 in the past 2 years.
As you go into a clubhouse, even in the independent leagues, do they have rules posted on the clubhouse wall?
Not so much posted on the clubhouse wall. I mean, our contracts are very detailed. I think it's more of an unwritten code that you just, when you're in that line of work, you don't bet on anything that you're involved with. It's more of a code of ethics.
It's hard to imagine that too many people bet on independent baseball games anyway.
No, you're right about that, Neil.
Good luck to you, Aaron. Make the big time.
Thank you.
Okay.
That's the reason, that Rose has said in his own defense that if you are on drugs, you have rehab. People say, well, you have ball players who have been accused of abusing their families. Right. That's terrible behavior. But the prime ordinance in baseball certainly proceeds from the 1919 World Series, which was fixed. And as soon as you look at a ball game and say, they're not trying, somebody's doing this, then you lose your faith in baseball, your interest in baseball. So the one thing you may not do within the world of baseball, the rules of baseball, is bet on baseball in any way, manner, shape, or form. And Pete ignored that in the same way that he ignored the fact that we all have to pay income taxes. I have to pay some money next week. Believe me, I'd rather go off to a warm climb. But Pete avoided his income taxes, and he went to prison. Pete went to Japan. He signed some photos and some baseball cards, and he brought more money back than you were allowed to bring into the United States, and he got caught at customs. Pete had a wonderful-looking car designed by Mario Andretti on a Porsche chassis that would go over 200 miles an hour. Not with me in it, and he got picked up by one of those plane cops in the air, and there was a huge fine assessed, and he ignored it, and finally the Reds were going to play a game. This was about 88, and the sheriff was going to go and arrest Pete Rose. The deputy sheriff knew Rose's lawyer, so what can I do? Said the lawyer, $2,500 certified check. So they gave that to the sheriff, and Rose, that was that. Why, I said, would you ignore a ticket for speeding? And Pete said, I'm Pete Rose. They're not going to bother me.
Aaron, whom we just spoke with, is a minor league ball player. You, at one point, Roger Kahn, were part owner of the minor league Utica Blue Sox and wrote a wonderful book about it called Good Enough to Dream.
Thank you.
What message do you think Rose's conduct, and more importantly, what message will baseball's response to his admission send to younger players?
Well, those are very good questions. I think Rose's response, if he were to be readmitted into the game and get into the Hall of Fame, is that you can get away with anything as long as you say, I'm sorry. And I think that's a bad message. I think one of the good things, great things about baseball led the country into integration. I was covering the Dodgers when Jackie Robinson was going through some very tough times. Before there was Martin Luther King, there was Jackie Robinson. That was wonderful. Baseball showed it's not the color of the skin. A box score doesn't show that. So we all learned a little bit about integration and people getting along with people. If you play baseball, you know, there are rules, you follow the rules. It's not four strikes, you're out. It's three strikes, you're out. It's not five balls, you get the first base. It's four. We like to think that our young people and even, you know, now minor league players and everybody else learns from the way baseball works that there are rules and there are standards and you can have a hell of a lot of fun, but you stay within the rules and the standards. If Pete gets back, then you say, you can break all the rules, ignore all the standards, and as long as you'd say, oh, I'm sorry, the standards and the rules don't mean anything.
Let's get another caller in. This is Cliff, who's with us from Flagstaff, Arizona.
Hey, how you doing, Neil?
All right.
Great. Glad I got in. Great show.
Thank you.
Yeah, I made the comment earlier that I think, and I agree with the gentleman that spoke just before me, certainly there's codes and ethics and rules and regulations, and they certainly need to be followed to set the example for the younger players up and coming in the sport. But I truly believe, in my own opinion, that Pete certainly does deserve to be in the Hall of Fame. However, not the Baseball Hall of Fame. He should be in the Liars Hall of Fame and should probably be there with a few other...
That's very funny.
...such as Nixon and Clinton. And, you know, it's, again, I mean, they're setting their own examples for themselves, so we should create a separate little... Hall of Fame for them specifically for you know their
sir, do you want to contribute to the construction of that building?
I'll
pledge any amount, but I'm not sure I'll honor it.
Yeah,
you know, I'll tell you just an odd story. I was fortunate enough to be in the Oval Office, and there's nothing to do with politics or the Iraqi War. I was the guest of the president for a stretch. And he said, I got a lot of pressure. I'm talking baseball. So let's just talk baseball, which, of course, was fine with me. And the president sets the agenda. I don't. And after a while, I started to tell him a story about Billy Morton, manager of the Yankees, a hard drinker. And every other word Billy used began with F. And I started to tell President Bush's story with the word F, and I couldn't get it out. And I said, bleep. And I thought, wait a minute. I can't get that word out in this office, and look what Bill Clinton did in his office. Anyway, that's just having respect for our institutions. I don't think Pete has much of that either.
Cliff, thanks very much for the call.
You bet. Have a great day.
You too. And Roger Kahn, we thank you very much for your time today.
Hi, it's a pleasure talking to you, Neil. And if you ever buy a minor league club, give me a call, and maybe we can go into it together and see how much money we can lose.
We'll try that very much. Roger Kahn is the author of The Boys of Summer, recently named the Ottaway Professor of Journalism at the State University of New York at New Paltz, and he spoke with us from his home in Stone Ridge, New York. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. There is no town in the United States where this story hits harder than the Queen City, Cincinnati. Paul Daugherty has been a sports columnist for the Cincinnati Inquirer since the late 1980s. He joins us now by phone from his office there. Good of you to be with us today.
Hi, Neil. How are you?
Good. I understand you wrote a column for Monday's paper when this story first leaked out. What'd you say?
I said that it was typical of Pete Rose that the confession was paid. He was paid for saying what he said.
And what reaction did you get to that?
I was amazed. You know, like I said, I've been here since 1988, and I thought I knew the town pretty well, especially on this topic. But I probably got 100 emails in the before noon on Tuesday, or Wednesday rather, when it was written Tuesday. I'd say that 90 of them were favorable for me. I expected the exact opposite.
Now, this was the same town that had 40,000 people in the seats when Pete Rose played a softball game to close Synergy Field.
That's right. Absolutely.
And, you know, everybody thought that Pete Rose could be a elected king of Cincinnati, much less mayor.
Well, maybe those 40,000 people don't have the internet. I don't know. Yeah, you're right. It's very strange.
Now, for the 10% who disagreed with you, what did they say?
Well, these Neil, the same people who, if Pete Rose assassinated the Pope in the morning, would be telling you in the afternoon what a great ball player he was. I mean, they're just loyalists. There are some people who will love Pete for where he came from and who he was and how he spoke to them as a baseball player, no matter what he does.
And he was a great, great player. Let us never forget that.
No question.
We got a caller on the line. Elizabeth is with us from Greensboro, North Carolina.
Hi, I'm originally from Cincinnati and definitely a diehard Reds fan and Pete Rose fan. But I will say that I'm embarrassed about his, you know, problems and lying, and particularly his latest admissions. But I think that for me, the Hall of Fame is to honor and remember athletic accomplishments and achievements. And I think that, you know, Pete Rose, he's a record breaker, and he belongs in the Hall of Fame for his athletic accomplishments and achievements. If it were a character issue, then there are people who are already in the Hall of Fame that wouldn't have a place there. But what we're remembering in the Hall of Fame is their athleticism.
Paul Daugherty, is Elizabeth's opinion a common one in Cincinnati?
Yes, it is. It's one that I've held almost since the day he was banished. I've said it from day one: honor the player, punish the gambler. We don't know that Pete Rose bet on baseball as a player. Everything so far has been as a manager. As she said, the Hall of Fame has a front door, not pearly gates. If I took my kids to Cooperstown, I don't tell them that we're here to see Boy Scouts and Popes. We're here to see ball players, and they're flawed human beings, but they deserve to be honored for what they did on the field, and certainly Pete has the credentials to be in the Hall of Fame.
A lot of people would say, hey, put Shoeless Joe Jackson in, one of the eight men out of the 1919 Black Sox. Put him in before you put Pete Rose in.
And you might have a case there. In fact, the supporters of Shoeless Joe are eagerly anticipating, awaiting what's going to happen with Pete.
Elizabeth, thanks very much for the call.
All right, thanks for taking my call.
We appreciate it. Any other reaction thus far in Cincinnati?
You know what, like I said, the predominant reaction, particularly among those who have supported Pete throughout the last 14 years, was betrayal, disappointment. I mean, these are the same people, not just here, but nationally, who have been behind him and were indirectly responsible for Bud Selig having a change of heart about this. I mean, what the ovations that Pete got at the introduction of the All-Century team and again at the World Series 2 years ago were from people who believed in him, and I think most of those people now feel a little bit betrayed.
Paul Daugherty, a sports columnist for the Cincinnati Inquirer, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
We'll continue our conversation about Pete Rose and the nature of apologies when we come back. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Tomorrow, join Ira Flatow on Science Friday for a look at one way that researchers are trying to move computing on beyond silicon to use the world of biology, plus a look through the lens at Mars. That's tomorrow on Talk of the Nation. And in a few minutes on Talk of the Nation today, we're going to switch subjects and talk to Jessica Matthews of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace about a report issued by her organization today that came to the conclusion that Iraq presented no threat to the United States before the start of the war last spring. We've been talking about Pete Rose's admission of guilt, but how was his apology? And are some apologies better than others? Joining us now is Professor of Communications Keith Herrett, who teaches at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo. Mr. Herrett joins us from his home there, and welcome you to Talk of the Nation.
Well, thank you, Neil.
Did Pete Rose apologize?
He did, but we would label it really a failed apology.
In what sense?
Well, we like to say that a good apology really meets four criteria. And I think Pete Rose's apology failed on all four levels. First off, it needs to deal with the problem of guilt by straightforwardly accepting it. You can't blame others. The fact that baseball has a program for substance abuse but not for gambling. Second, it needs to be well performed. We need to be able to look in his eye and really tell that he meant it, read his body language and the like. And the fact that he chose to do it in print rather than on television, really hurt him, I think, in this regard, for us to not really be able to tell whether or not he clearly meant it. Third, we expect them to be voluntary. They can't be forced into or a sense of coercion or just the odds are so stacked against me, this is the last chance I have kind of thing. And I think a previous caller alluded to the fact that this was kind of a paid-for apology. In Pete Rose's case, it came across as much more of a calculated move than one in which he's engaged in moral reflection. And then finally, it needs to complete the drama, right, in the sense of satisfying public expectations for what an apology is. And, you know, one of the things I like to say is that it should end the story, and the fact that we're still talking about it 2 or 3 days afterwards, and as you go online, you see more and more news stories being generated about it, we would say it fails on that point as well.
Well, let's compare what Pete Rose had to say with another apology that was issued this week. Last night, Governor John Rowland of Connecticut admitted that he did accept gifts from state employees and from those who do business with the state and had lied about it.
But worse, I was wrong in failing to truthfully address these issues. I lied, and there are no excuses. My mistakes are my own, and I offer my sincerest apologies to the people of Connecticut, to my own family, to the people that I work with, and to our legislators and other public officials whom I share a very important public duty with.
Professor Harrod, how does that compare with what you have seen from Pete Rose?
Oh, I think it was an excellent apology. My only criticism or complaint that I would have about it is that he's really repeated President Clinton's mistake in that he delivered his second apology, or his best apology, second rather than first.
Hmm.
If you remember, after the Monica Lewinsky affair, he had the first combative apology, and then 2 or 3 weeks later, delivered a much more contrite apology before a national prayer breakfast. Similarly, according to my data, Governor Rowland apologized first on December 16th, and of course he waited until January 7th to give the good apology that people would have looked him in the eye and said, yes, he really meant it, and I can give him the benefit of the doubt now.
And we should note that the day that his book came out, and more than a week after this controversy started to erupt, Pete Rose issued a secondary apology, a written statement this week, in which he said he was deeply sorry for all of the trouble that he had caused, and expressed some language. And again, that sort of serial confession.
Exactly, and I think that is one of the biggest problems for apologists is they want to and they need to complete the story, and if their apologies aren't successful, they get into the position in which they're apologizing again and again and again. And, you know, just like with the case with Trent Lott this past a year ago December, every time they apologize thereafter, they look more and more weak.
Let's get a caller in on this. Marilyn joins us on the line from San Jose, California. Hello, Marilyn, are you there?
Yes, I am here.
Hi, you're on the air.
Thank you very much. Great to talk to you.
Thank you.
My first point is I want to make is I have no particular interest in baseball. This is not my call is about. It is the bigger situation. Now, Mr. Rose was a member of the baseball industry. He knew what the rules were. He knew the penalties, and still he did them. Howsomever, I have to say, you know, and I'm not a biblical type, but the Bible says he was without sin, cast the first stone. There are none of us who are without sin, and I am just truly tired of this, asking somebody to grovel, to totally grovel. I mean, whatever kind of apology anybody makes, it doesn't matter. The public seems to want them to just totally get down in the mud and the S word and grovel. And I don't think any of us are that clean.
Well, let me ask Professor Harrod about that. Is there a certain level at which, you know, obviously different members of the community will hear apologies in a different way? And you know, forgiveness is supposed to be, you know, part of our grace.
Most certainly. And, you know, I think that's what's so interesting about apologies is that when they're utilized, they tend to draw upon, you know, very religious terminology and very religious language. If you go back to Governor Rowland's apology, he used terms like this period of testing. I'm trying to redeem myself. I've wrestled with John Rowland. And so, you know, there definitely is that sort of religious component. I think to respond more to the caller, though, there is a sense that one of the things the public really wants and needs, and I think one of the most pro-social things about an apology, is that an apologist basically comes clean and says, I agree with or I give adherence to the very values that I broke. The social standards, the rules in our society and in our culture still are meaningful. And so, if you will, a good apology kind of restores faith back in the whole system or social system.
Marilyn, thanks very much.
Well, wait a minute.
Go ahead.
Well, outside of that fundamentalist, and I can't remember his name at the moment.
Jimmy Swaggart,
Jim Baker, one or the other.
Nobody seems to agree that anybody has done a sufficient, confession, apology, or whatever else, and.
Well, let me ask Professor Herod about that. Is there an example you can cite for us of somebody who got it right off the bat, who did it right the first time?
In terms of a public performance of an apology, I think there's two very famous ones, of course, that stand out. The historic Nixon-Checker speech, in which he was accused by the Democrats during the Eisenhower administration that he had a Republican slush fund going on, and he talked about how poor he and his wife Pat were, and that she wore a Republican coat.
Cloth coat.
And they had this dog, Checkers, that they just weren't going to give back. Ted Kennedy's apology after the death of Mary Jo Kopechne, I think, was one that very much met and satisfied public expectations. But if you look at that apology, he did deal with the problem of guilt, and he, in effect, said to the people of Massachusetts, my future is in your hands. And, of course, the next day, the family was flooded with positive telegrams encouraging Senator Kennedy to keep his Senate seat.
And, of course, there are people who will never forgive either Richard Nixon or Ted Kennedy for those and other deeds.
Exactly. And that's why I come back to an apology is really a rhetoric of failure. There's no such thing as a truly successful apology. The most famous one of all time, Socrates, in his apology for corrupting the youth of Athens, he was forced to drink the hemlock afterwards. I think the only idea of a successful apology is people go, okay, he came clean or she came clean, let's move on, end of story.
Professor Herod, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Professor Keith Herod is a communications professor from Western Michigan University, and he spoke to us from his home in Kalamazoo. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.